Welcome, everyone, to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley, a national news and talk program dedicated to military veterans issues. And now, your hosts, David Corey and Richard Hurley.
Welcome to the Veterans News Hour for July 10th, 2017. This is David Corey along with my co-host Richard Hurley. Thanks for joining us this evening. Hello, Richard.
Hello, David, and good evening to our listeners. We're back to have another great show. We're going to have some news affecting our veterans and their families. In addition to the news from Washington tonight, we welcome our guest Anthony Doran from Phillipsburg, New Jersey. In our past shows, we have interviewed men and women, veterans and non-veterans, who are helping our veterans and their families to deal with life after the military. The adjustment back into civilian life can be challenging and at times almost impossible. Anthony Doran works for Vets for Warriors, which is a 24/7 confidential peer support line for veterans, active military, and their families to provide a live chat and an understanding connection. The program uses a confidential phone calls, chats, email, and social media to deliver personalized peer support. But before I welcome Anthony to our show and find out more about Anthony and his organization, David, I know there's more news affecting our vets, so what's new in D.C.?
Yeah, that's correct, Richard. Before I update our listeners on what's new in Washington, I'd like to quickly recognize and thank the sponsors of tonight's show, including American Legion's John F. Murphy Post 303 of Bonita Springs, Florida, Mr. Charles M. Newman of Florida, and Corey and Hurley Law Group, which represents veterans in disability cases and military personnel actions. Now, for what's new in D.C., here is information from various press releases released this past week from the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee. A bipartisan bill called the Veterans Education Relief and Reinstatement Act, or VERA, has been introduced by Senators Richard Blumenthal, Tom Tillis, John Tester, Dean Heller, Dick Durbin, and Todd Young. VERA would expand the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs authority to restore post-9/11 GI Bill benefits of veterans who were affected by the permanent closure of various educational institutions, including ITT Tech and other schools. Currently, the VA cannot fully restore veterans' benefits if a school they attend permanently closes. This bill is a significant step towards protecting veterans' hard-earned education benefits as they transition from military to civilian life, providing them with peace of mind that they did not suffer the loss of educational opportunities due to unexpected school closures. According to Senator Blumenthal, quote, "Our veterans have too often been left high and dry by abrupt school closures, which prevent them from completing their degrees and waste millions of dollars in post-9/11 GI Bill benefits," unquote. Now, this bill, if enacted into law, would provide the Department of Veterans Affairs with the authority to do two major things. First, restore entitlement for individuals, including student veterans affected by the ITT Technical Institute's collapse, who pursued a program of education with VA educational assistance and failed to receive credit or lost training time towards completion of an individual's educational, professional, or vocational objective as a result of the closure of that educational institution. And second, the legislation would continue monthly educational assistance payments, including housing allowance, through the end of the term, quarter, or semester in which the school closes, up to 4 months from the date of the school closure, whichever is sooner. Now, these extensions would be without charge to the entitlement. Senator Tester, who was the ranking Democrat on the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee, stated, and I quote, "After putting their lives on hold to serve our country, our veterans have earned access to the best education possible when they leave the armed forces. This bipartisan bill will ensure they have access to that education and the tools they need to succeed after their service," unquote. In other news from Washington, Senator Tester, along with Senator Bozeman from Arkansas, introduced legislation called the Homeless Veterans Reintegration Program Improvement Act. which will strengthen job training for at-risk veterans and fight veteran homelessness. This is important legislation, which stipulates that veterans who currently receive housing assistance under the Department of Housing and Urban Development's Veterans Affairs Support Housing Program, or Native American Housing Assistance and Supportive Services for Veterans Families programs, that they still remain eligible to receive valuable assistance such as job training from the VA under what's called the Homeless Veterans Reintegration Program. So this legislation would be important for a number of things, reasons. It would extend the Veterans Reintegration Program for 5 years. It would extend the Homeless Veterans and Homeless Veterans with Children's Reintegration Program for another 5 years. And it would clarify that veterans that are participating in the Department of Housing and Urban Development's programs were still eligible for the VA's Veteran Reintegration Program. So that's very important. It would also clarify that American Indians participating in Native American housing assistance programs are also eligible for the VA assistance, and that veterans participating in the Supportive Services for Veteran Families program are also eligible. Now, I know that's a lot of technical information about the law, but again, the overriding goal is basically to help veterans to fight homelessness among the veteran population and to strengthen job training for at-risk veterans. Very important goal. As Senator Bozeman, who's a co-sponsor of legislation, stated, and I quote, "The Homeless Veterans Reintegration Program is an important resource to breaking the cycle of veteran homelessness. We need to build on the accomplishments of this proven program and provide our veterans with the training and tools they need for long-term success. I am pleased to have Senator Tester continue to join me in this fight to provide our veterans with stable housing and job training opportunities," unquote. And again, it appears to be bipartisan legislation. And then in other news from Washington, Senator Tester joined with Senator Dan Sullivan from Alaska to introduce the Serving Our Rural Veterans Act of 2017. That legislation would authorize the VA to have a pilot program to have medical students conduct their residencies with the VA in more rural facilities, such as tribal health care facilities in remote areas, because there are some veterans that live in states such as Alaska, where they're really hundreds and sometimes even literally thousands of miles away from established VA facilities. So this program is one of a number of bills to help veterans get access to the care they need. And then finally, I'd like to make one more note about the proposed legislation that's pending. It's the Veterans Appeals Improvement and Modernization Act of 2017. We've talked about this legislation for many weeks on this show, and the law firm of Corey and Hurley maintained that this legislation, which is S-1024 and H.R. 2288, is really more for the convenience of the VA. It has a nice sounding title. They're going to improve and modernize the appeal system, but it's basically our prediction after we've studied this legislation and reviewed comments of other informed groups like the Vietnam Veterans of America. We believe this legislation will make it easier for the VA to deny appeals rather than actually helping veterans. It passed the House already, unfortunately. It's now pending action in the Senate. So we urge listeners, contact their senators. Go to Senate.gov to find out who your two U.S. senators are from your state. Well, Richard, that's a quick overview of news from Washington this week. I know we have a special guest tonight, and before turning the interview back over to you, I'd like to remind our listeners this is a call-in show. Our call-in toll-free number is, if you want to grab a pen and paper, is 1-888-627-6008. Again, the call-in number is 1-888-627-6008. Back to you, Richard.
Thank you, David, and wow, that was a lot of news from D.C. You know, it's good to see that there's some legislation out there that's getting bipartisan support and that our elected officials are working together to try to help our veterans. And we're going to keep a watchful eye on that Veterans Appeals Improvement and Modernization Act of 2017, because as you said, David, that is not good news for our vets. And at this time, I want to introduce our guest, Anthony Dorn, from New Jersey. Anthony is a veteran who served in Afghanistan. After separating from the military, Anthony went through his own personal trials and tribulations, which he will share with us tonight. He now works for Vets Impactful Warriors as a mental health specialist peer counselor. This program provides peer counseling 24/7 for our veterans and their families. Anthony, welcome to Corey and Hurley Veterans News Hour.
Well, thank you guys for having me. I really appreciate it.
How's everything in the great state of New Jersey?
Well, it was kind of hot today, but all in all, everything is going good up here.
Yeah, that's where I'm still licensed as a lawyer in New Jersey, so I spent 25 years up there practicing law.
Yeah, so, Anthony, too far away from our office there.
Yeah, that's we've been talking about that. I was president of the bar there. And Anthony, before we get to the organization you work for, please tell me a little bit about your own service. I know you enlisted in the Army around 2003, I think you said. And tell us a little bit about what happened about your service when you joined the Army.
Okay. Well, like you said, I'm from Phillipsburg, New Jersey, one of four boys, who also I have two other brothers that served and did time overseas as well. It was September 11th, 2001. It was in a community college up here, and I was in class in the morning, and the first tower was hit. As I was driving home, classes were canceled, as I was driving home, I came home to my parents' house where I was living at the time and, watched both towers fall. Something I will never forget, especially, people, I was, 20 years old at the time, 19, 20 years old.
Anthony, where was your parents' house? I'm curious.
Alpha, New Jersey.
Okay.
And, so that's something that was, in my time, that was our Pearl Harbor. And it's something that, like I said, I will never forget. I tried to finish school. And, within a year and a half, I signed up for and was shipped out to Fort Benning, Georgia, where I did my infantry training down there and also airborne training. And they sent me to, I went in unassigned airborne. I had the choices of to go in unassigned or go to Fort Polk, Louisiana. Well, I'm glad I picked unassigned, and they sent me out to the 25th Infantry out in Hawaii. And there I was with the 2nd Battalion, 35th Infantry Regiment, and, I was able to train with all of my guys, and then we shipped over about a year later to Kandahar, Afghanistan. That's where we arrived, and that's where we did a lot of our time was southeast Afghanistan, and then we went out to our own fire base, Lagman, I believe it was Kalat. So we did most of our missions were down southeast, and that was during the time of the presidential election for Afghanistan. So we were in charge of, guarding ballots, make sure that the ballots got back and forth to where they need to be, and the Taliban, Al Qaeda did not like that very much. What they would do is how their system was with the ink and thumb on the piece of paper. That's how they voted. And even with, the Taliban and Al Qaeda, they, three quarters of the country were able to still vote, even though they risked death. They would walk miles upon miles just to vote. And I mean, if somebody was walking back with ink on their thumb, they would either cut off their thumb, kill their family, kill them, whatever it took to scare people not to vote, but they still voted. And I thought that was actually, unbelievable that these people still went out and they wanted change. We did a lot of humanitarian missions, a lot of QRF, quick reaction force, and, a lot of, we went out to get HVTs, high-value targets, things like that. So we were busy all year round. I re-enlisted to stay in the Army for another 4 years in February of 2005. My deployment was April 2004 to April 2005. And a month after I reenlisted, in March, I tweaked my back somehow. I'm not really sure how I did it, but I just maybe just wear and tear, carrying a lot of weight, walking up and down. It's, very hard on your body. I came back on leave and, had to get it taken care of because at that point I couldn't I could barely walk. And, you know, in the old, you know, military, especially in the infantry world, it was suck it up. So, and you didn't go to sick call. So I let it go until it got worse and worse. Finally, where I couldn't walk, I had to go to sick call. And from there on, that's when I was seeing all the doctors, physical therapy, physical medicine, getting shots in my back. And the last straw was surgeon, and she wanted to operate, and I said, no, thank you. And that was December of 2006. And that was, at that time, that was my introduction to pain medication. And from there on, that's part of my story is, you know, I got out in, I'm sorry, that was December 2005, because I got out in July of 2006, where I got medically discharged honorably. And she said, basically, they gave me a choice. I can stay in and basically do paperwork or get out. And because with or without the surgery, my surgeon said, you know, I will not be able to do my job again. And that was, for me, that was a tough pill to swallow, especially since I just reenlisted. My unit was deploying to Iraq in August of 2006. I wanted to go with them, but that's when I started to drink heavily before I even got out, and, you know, mixing with medications. I got out, like I said, in July of 2006, continued with medication, but then my drinking really picked up when I got back. You know, I wasn't working at the time. They gave me a severance pay, and I was just basically drinking every night for, you know, 2 to 3 months straight until I started to, you know, work full time. And that kind of ceased a little bit, regressed a little bit, but I was still the weekend warrior, you know, Saturday night, then it turns into Thursday to Sunday, then Wednesday, then Monday night football, and it just any excuse to get out there and, you know, forget, suppress, because I didn't know how to talk about anything. I didn't want to talk about anything, and that's not how I was raised, and that's not how we were bred, and, you know, in the military.
Anthony, let me ask you, when you were now out, were you seeking assistance with the VAs, any sort of counseling?
No. Honestly, I didn't know anything much about the VA until 2009. So it took me about three years to get integrated with the VA. And
You were kind of left on your own then?
Yes. That's how I felt. I honestly didn't know anything about the VA. There was a small little brief packet when you were getting out of the military. And, you know, at that point, you're just going through the motions. There wasn't really a sit down, a schooling. It was just a packet. Here, read the packet. And, you know, you just have a whole folder full of paperwork. And the last thing, honestly, at that time I wanted to do was read through, you know, all these packets of paperwork. Even though, you know, with the guilt and the shame of me getting out and not deploying with my friends was a big hit to me.
Yeah, I can imagine that. I know you said your brothers served, but did your mother or father serve?
No, my father he's a retired police officer.
Okay,
you know, my great uncles and grandfather were in the service. World War II
era. You had some family that was. That were veterans. Were you able to get any support from them, any assistance with what you were going through?
No. I didn't. To be honest, I didn't reach out to them. I didn't know how. I didn't know how to talk about it. And in my world, if I was reaching out, that appears to be weak. And that's not me handling my own business, my own stuff. I know how I feel. Why am I going to tell you how I feel? And that was my attitude toward that.
So, you said you kind of went through this for about 3 years until about 2009. And
yeah,
what happened in 2009?
2009, I got into a little trouble with the law, and it involved prescription medication. At that time, I was extremely hooked on, you know, the opiates, pain medication. I was, you know, doctor shopping. Getting different prescriptions, mixing different prescriptions. I was also prescribed Xanax. So I was, you know, basically heavily sedated every day.
Who was prescribing the Xanax to you?
The VA.
VA.
Mm-hmm.
And how often would you go to the VA when they were prescribing the Xanax for you? Were you going there to get them, you know, have them check up on you, and or were they just basically re-prescribing?
Well, I went to two mental health doctors at the VA after 2009. I went to a psychologist where I would go in and basically stare at her for an hour because I didn't know how to talk to her, and just tell her everything's fine, everything's good. And then another time I would go to the psychiatrist where I would go in and tell her about my anxiety and my sleeplessness and restlessness and irritability and everything that came along with it. And, you know, she was prescribed me the medication, but then I would manipulate for more because it wasn't doing the job. So I wanted something, you know, stronger that would sedate me, basically.
Mm. I know there did come a time when your brother unfortunately passed away. And what year was that?
That was 2013.
Okay, so from 2009
until
2009 about 2013, what were you doing?
I was trying to live, basically. I didn't know how to live the way I was living. Like I said, I was still a guilt and shame. I was in and out of rehabs, detoxes, the PTSD ward in 2012, the VA rehab. I was going through all these treatment centers and I would get out and I would go right back to doing what I was doing. And honestly, when I left these treatment centers, if I took a polygraph, I truly believed that I was going to, stay sober or be able to control, my medication or my drinking. I truly believed that. And I just wasn't ready to listen, to what people were telling me. I thought I can do it on my own. I thought I'll be okay. I was just very, at that time, I was hard-headed as well and very stubborn and determined to do it on my own that, no, I can do this. I'm okay. And that's that mentality of suck it up. I got it. I'll work it out. It's my problem. I'll handle it. And in the meantime, I wasn't talking about my issues, what was going on, you know, internally. I would just suppress it. And so basically from 2009 to 2013, February, I was in and out of treatments, losing relationships. I attempted suicide three times, twice tried to overdose. And once I was, I tied 550 cord to the back of my door. I just sat with the noose around my neck and I was ready to go. And as I started to go, I didn't want to die. And, you know, at that point I didn't want to die, but I didn't know how to live. And I was lost. I was very lost. I didn't know who I can turn to, who I can reach out to. I didn't think anybody could understand. And the guys that I thought could understand had it together. They were getting married. They were having kids. They were living a good life, guys that I served with. And talking to them now, and being open and honest, and, you know, now I know that's not true. We just were never talking about it to each other because we all thought we had it all together. And so in 2013, after my brother Joey passed, and he was also in the infantry, he was in Iraq, and he just got out of the VA rehab, and 2 days later he was found dead in a hotel 2 days later. And...
Was that a suicide?
No. It was, I mean, it wasn't a suicide. There was no note or anything like that, but, I know he was struggling with a lot of demons, and he never got the help he needed as well. When he got out of the VA, there was no aftercare plan. It was just, okay, we'll see you later. Here's a piece of paper. And there was no follow-up with IOP or halfway house or, you know, things to kind of guide him and transition him back into civilization. They kind of said, here you go. He wound up in a hotel, and 2 days later, he was dead. And they didn't find him until 2 days later. And we weren't able to even have an open casket for him.
So Anthony, you and I have talked about recovery. We share some a common bond in that regard. When did you have that moment, as I like to call it, the moment of awakening, that moment of enlightenment that you changed? You indicated you did not want to die, you did not want to live. But so how did you change? How did you pivot and move on and get where you are today? What happened?
Well, I had a great opportunity, and it was through a civilian treatment center. It was probably within the week. My sobriety date is February 22nd. My brother's death was February 10th. So, but I went to the VA psych ward on February 20th to basically try to detox and get the help I needed. And in that meantime, people that love and care about me, and I have great support, great family support and friend support, and which I'm so grateful for, they were reaching out to different organizations, different places, and they came across a place called Alina Lodge in Blairstown, New Jersey.
I know it well.
Yeah, and they were able to reach out to a donor, and anonymously they donated 150 grand for me to go to this place.
Wow.
And I still don't know who it is to this day, so I look at it as my lottery ticket of life, because in there is when I was able to change, when I was able to talk about what was going on. But it took about 2 months for me to kind of clear the cobwebs in there. I was in there for about 10 and a half months. And there, things started to change, my behaviors, my thinking, because I was actually writing things down, I was getting honest, and I was talking to another human being. Things that I thought I was taking to the grave. And that's when things started to change. That's when, like I said, my behaviors, my way of thinking, I had that hope. Hope started to enter my life. Like, you know what? Maybe I can do something. I started to hear it from other people who would come in and speak and tell their story. And, even some people that would come in there that were veterans, would tell their story, and I would sit there and like, they're telling my story. And that gave me hope. It's just hearing it from somebody else that, I wasn't alone, that I'm not unique in my story. People have, some of the same, behaviors or circumstances, maybe not some of the same experiences, but how I was dealing with them, very similar, if not the same. But the most important thing that I heard about all of this stuff was the solution. We can all have that as they call it, the drunk log or drug log, or, live in the past and talk about that. But they would talk about what they did and what they're doing now and how they continue to, be a productive member of society, how they're helping others. And that's where something clicked for me. And when I got out of that place, I did go to a halfway house for 6 months. It was, and that's another thing I was doing. I was following suggestions from other people. And the suggestion was to stay at a halfway house for 6 months. And I did that, even though I wanted to leave at 4 months because, I was doing really well. I had an opportunity to move in with somebody, and I called the place and I wanted their blessing. And, one of the guys there, one of the head counselor, said, no, he has to finish. And I'm so grateful that he said that, because I needed those extra 2 months. And, from there, I was working. I was gainfully employed. I was helping others. I was doing commitments. I was going to the VA, to the PTSD unit. I had a friend there. I would go there every Thursday after my therapy session, and I would hang out with the guys and, talk about things and just be a part of. And it was that's where I wanted to be, and that's where I felt most comfortable about talking about certain things. And like I said, being part of the solution and talking to others like me and talking about their struggles, and they're asking me, how did I do it, how did you get where you're at? And then I would be able to talk about it, and I never thought that I would be able to. I was hopeless, powerless, all of those things that come with it, and you know, with the guilt and the shame. But I was able to find that light, and that was through others.
And you eventually found your way to Vets for Warriors. When was that?
Yes. I started there in, it was November of 2014 when I first started there. A buddy of mine approached me that March of 2014, and he you know, saw the work that I was doing, and him being a combat vet as well, and from a local guy that my younger brother grew up with. He said, you know, I just got hired by this company. You know, we help veterans. It's a peer support line. I think you'd be really great at this. And we're hiring, so apply. So I applied in March, and I wound up getting hired because they were going through stuff with the DOD, and I can get into that a little bit later. But there was a freeze, and then once we were funded again, I was hired in November of 2014. And from there, it's just been a blessing to be able to give back. And I think the key thing for me is being able to self-disclose. Like everything I just shared with you, I'm able to self-disclose with another veteran or an active duty, military member or a family member or caregiver about the experiences I had. But how I got through them, and then helping them, guide them for the solution, you know, whether it be just relating to them, talking about them, talking through that, establishing goals, getting them the resources they need, and then following up with them next week.
I wanted to mention something because I was doing some research on Vets for Warriors, and it has quite a history, and there was an impact of the death of Sergeant Coleman Bean, who was also
yes.
a New Jersey resident, and Coleman had entered he had enlisted 6 days before 9/11, and he served from 2001 until 2015, and he got out, and he was suffering real badly from PTSD. In fact, he was diagnosed by the military as well as the VA for PTSD, and then he was called back into service in 2007, and he did about another year, knowing, you know, the VA and the military knew this man was suffering from PTSD, and yet they sent him back. He came back in 2008, and then he took his own life, and his story got the attention of the late New Jersey Senator Frank Lautenberg, as well as Congressman Rush Holt, who they played a role in getting Vets for Warriors going. Isn't that kind of the way it all came into fruition?
Yeah, he committed suicide in September of 2008, and in 2011 they started with just basically it was covering 50 states, basically four U.S. territories, and it was for National Guard and Reserve when they first started. And that was in 2011. And Chris Kossoff, he was the director of the UBHC building at the time, and he had a role in that as well. And basically from there, it grew. And then it became, and when the DOD got involved, it became, they started working with the VA crisis line, and it became for all active members. But at that time, there was nothing for veterans, and then they started a vet-to-vet program at Vets for Warriors at the same building. And when DOD stopped funding us, I think that was 2015, 16 of August, I believe. It's one of those, but they stopped funding us, and we went private, and basically, we combined both programs. So now we can say, you know, Vets for Warriors is for anybody who's worn a uniform, doesn't matter their character of discharge, whether it's honorable, dishonorable, it does not matter. We will serve anybody, family members, caregivers, friends of who have been impacted by the service member. Because a lot of times we have friends call in concerned about their friend who, you know, is maybe a veteran or an active duty member, and maybe they're spiraling out of control and they're drinking. And, you know, we strongly urge them to have them give us a call, because we just can't reach out to anybody because somebody asked us to. It's just we run into certain problems there. And if somebody doesn't want us to call, you know, we can't call, although we would love to. But we just can't. We have to respect the privacy of that person. But and then from there, go ahead.
The concept of the peer support network, you know, give me a little bit, you know, kind of an example of what would happen on a day that, for you, for instance, a veteran calls in, and what action are you immediately taking on behalf of the veteran?
I am a combat vet of Afghanistan, Army vet, and I'm a role of however I can relate to this individual that's calling. Even if it's a Marine or Air Force, it doesn't matter. And let's just say somebody only wants to talk to another Marine. Well, we'll try to provide that for them. We'll try to get them on the phone with another Marine, or a female with a female, whatever they're most comfortable with, whatever moves them forward from what they're going through. And, you know, but it's reciprocal for us. And that's something that we stress, and that was created in the UBHC building by a woman named Sheree Castellano. And it's, you know, RSP, which is reciprocal peer support. So, and there's like four components for a task. And some of the components, you know, one is connection, info gathering, case management, and, you know, resilience affirmation. And that's something where, you know, we have to connect with the person calling, you know, just establish some sort of connection, relate with them some way, shape, or form, you know, and then we can gather info. Because sometimes it's somebody that it's, even though we say it's confidential, they still have trust. They don't want to give out their information because they think the cops are going to be knocking down their door because some of the things they may say. So, and we get that, and it's just, it can take trust and time, and we're not out to you know, get anybody in trouble. We also have, you know, resources for our active duty, you know, to get mental health outside of base, so their chain of command doesn't have to know. And that's a great resource that we provide as well. Another thing is case management. So if I have a caller that calls in, that's a veteran, active duty, a family member, whoever it is, now, and I'm talking to them, and I'm establishing rapport and connection, and, you know, we're getting through, we're moving forward. After we hang up, I'll be the one calling that person back. But they can always call in at any time, and if I'm not available, they can talk to any peer that's working. And, you know, we're there any day of the year, you know, 24/7. You know, and also it's goal. We set goals, you know, so if somebody's calling in that's struggling with whatever it is, you know, we try to find the problem. And a lot of times people are calling in, I'll give you an example. It's they're mad at their shoes, you know, and I'm just being ridiculous, but the shoe's not really the problem. You know, there's something else going on. So we try to talk it out. We try to find out what's really going on. And just little hints here and there, that's when I can self-disclose my story a little bit. And, you know, it could be, but I want them to know that they're not alone, that, you know, I went through what I went through, and that they can trust me and that we can get through this together. And that's something where, you know, it takes, you know, some getting used to. It's, you know, you just can't sit in a chair and answer the call and it's going to be smooth, because sometimes people are angry. They just dealt with the VA, or they just had a domestic dispute, or whatever the case may be, they may be agitated. And, you know, when somebody's calling in yelling at you, it's sometimes your first instinct is to kind of come back at them, you know, and it's that's something we have to put aside, and it's about them. It's about helping them through what they're going through. And by the end of the conversation, you know, we're thanking each other, and that's what it's all about. Those are the calls that somebody calls in irritated at the VA, and they think we're associated with the VA or some other entity. And, you know, and that's something that we can, you know, kind of talk them off the ledge, so to speak, talk them down, let them know.
Now,
that,
Anthony,
you know, they can...
I know you're not associated with the VA, but you are associated with Rutgers University, isn't that right?
Yes, we are.
How's that connection?
Well, that's who UBHC is, Rutgers University Behavioral Health Center. That's who started the initial Vets for Warriors in 2011. So that's what the employees who first started there in 2011, they were all Rutgers employees. And then when the DOD took over, people that came on after that were government contractors. And, you know, like when I first got hired, I was part of the DOD. We worked for a subcontractor from the DOD, but the rest were still Rutgers employees. So there were some Rutgers employees and then DOD employees. Once DOD left, we all became Rutgers employees. So we fall under the Rutgers label. So Rutgers is my employer since we are at the Rutgers University Behavioral Health Center.
And I also, your program is also 24/7, right?
Yes, 24/7, 365. We're there on Christmas, 4th of July, any holiday of the year, any night. You know, just like it says, 24/7, 365. And it's, you know, it's manned by peers, veteran peers, and there's no prompts. So if somebody calls, they get a live peer answering the call and answering the questions.
Well, you know, Anthony, you hear so many veterans complain about, you know, calling their congressman or even calling, I think Trump gave his phone number out, and none of these veterans ever get a call back, and they get so disgusted with the whole process.
And it's, you know, I'm glad you mentioned that because so many service members have called in, and some of our suggestions is because, you know, we don't know what else to say sometimes because they basically tackle all avenues the right way of how to approach the situation that they're in through the VA. The patient's advocate is not returning their calls. They can't even go to their office. So they write their congressman. They call in. They write. They do this. And with no response. And even though they say it's an open door or open policy where they can call in, we can it's they're not all like that. I have some cases where the congressman or the representative has called them back and has helped them through some things, but in most cases they don't.
Yeah,
I can't say all. Yeah, and it's sad.
No, I know we see it in our law practice all the time, and you get these kind of boilerplate letters that these congressmen send off on behalf of the veteran, and then they'll get a response back and they'll tell the veteran, well, we sent a letter. Well, I got about 100 of those letters sitting in various different files, and they're all the same, just a different name on the signature line. But, Anthony, I know you've got another program coming up on August the 5th. It's called Carry the Fallen Charity Ruck March. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what's going to happen on August the 5th and where?
Okay, well, it's happening here in New Jersey. We are one of 200-plus teams across the country. We started our team, my friend Greg started. He's a civilian who, when he heard the number 22, he just gasped and like, what? He didn't believe it. And he felt in his power he has to do something about this. And I got linked up with him because he's a local guy by me. And a friend of mine reached out to me and said, hey, you have to link up with him. He's doing this walk for veteran suicide. I said, I'm in. And we started our first walk. Well, he organized it. Our first walk, September 2014, when there was about 12 of us. And we did a 12-hour ruck march and almost 30 miles. And I'll tell you what, I was dead afterwards. But the whole point of it was... The whole point of it is that we are raising awareness for the veteran suicide, but we're also raising funds for a retreat out in Kentucky and it's through an organization called Active Heroes. And the founder of Active Heroes, his name is Troy Yoakum, and And this is, it's very close to him because his grandfather committed suicide. His grandfather was one of three brothers. They walked 30 miles to go sign after Pearl Harbor and out in Kentucky. And Troy, he started his walk across the country. He called it Hike for Heroes, and to raise the awareness of the veteran suicide. He started in April 17th, 2010, and ended in September 3rd, 2011. He walked 7,800 miles across 37 states.
Wow.
To raise the awareness, yeah. So, it obviously gained the attention. He was awarded, the Congressional Medal of Honor Society, Citizens Honors Medal, and basically from there, he took and he made the organization Active Heroes. And with Active Heroes, he was able to purchase a 144-acre piece of land. When we started in 2014, it was all brush and land, but he had the land. And from 2014 until now, he's been able to establish two community centers, basically one in Louisville and one in Shepherdsville. And at the Shepherdsville, where the retreat is, it has a bunch of cabins that are still being built, community center, but they offer a lot of, and it's free for service members, veterans, active duty, family members to go out and get away for a little while. There's counseling, acupuncture, yoga, archery, all this stuff just to get away from things for a while and work on yourself with your family. They also do outreach stuff as well. They will do cosmetics on somebody's home. They offer scholarships to, service members and their families, things like that. So they've done a lot of work from the time I started until now, and they continue to do work. And this ruck that we have coming up August 5th in Alpha, New Jersey, is last year we had about 200 people. We went from 12 to about 200. And it's just to see that all the people come out and raise the awareness. We walk through the streets now, and, people are wondering why we're walking. And we have pamphlets. We'll hand it out to people sitting, waiting in traffic for us to come by. And it gets the local community involved. It lets people be a part of, and to find that purpose of helping, being part of the solution of veteran suicide. And I think that's the main thing, because people see that number, and sometimes, they don't know what to do. They'll donate some money over here, which is great, but you can be actively involved. And because there's teams all across the country, they can look it up. It's activeheroes.org. They can go online, find out, whatever state they're in. We have three teams in New Jersey, and, with walks all year round. So, and we are, I believe, the last time we checked, that could have changed, but we were number four in the country for fundraising. Our team out here in Lehigh Valley, we're called Team Tenderfoots. And so we've been able to, and it's all grassroots, and we've been able to raise that much money over the past few years just through local donations, whether it be from, somebody's grandmother or the local PBA, or family members, people that just want to give for a good cause and a good purpose.
Anthony,
if they want to get involved, they can go out.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, how does someone get involved?
They can go on the website, and there's different links. The website it's pretty self-explanatory of what you want to do. They even have workout of the days in your area. So if you like to do fitness or workout, they also do, they're called WADS, Workout of the Day. And they also...
Is that the website vetsforwarriors.com?
That's the activeheroes.com.
Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry, activeheroes.org. That's for the walk.
Okay.
But how people can get involved for Vets for Warriors is we have ambassador programs. So anybody across the country, they can call us, and they say, hey, I want to be an ambassador for Vets for Warriors. What they have to do is they fill out. We send them all of our stuff, and they can go out and hand things out. They can set up booths if they want, and we give them all the material for free to go do that for Vets for Warriors.
Anthony, you guys have a number. Why don't you give the listening audience the telephone number for Vets for Warriors?
Okay. The telephone number for Vets for Warriors is 855. 838-8255. And they can also go on our website. They can chat in. They can go on our Facebook, Instagram. We're on social media now as well. They can email. However they feel comfortable of contacting us, they can do so. We have all means established where they can contact us through anything.
Well, that's great. Anthony, I want to thank you for being our guest tonight. We are running out of time. And I want to applaud you on your own recovery from as a friend of Bill's. Anthony, I got to tell you, I'm very proud of you and what you've done for yourself and what you're doing by giving back to others. So, you know, keep up the good work, and, you know, you and I'll be in touch on a lot of different things. And who knows, maybe I'll make it back up to Jersey and walk with you on August the 5th up there in Alpha.
That'd be great, Rich. And I'm really honored and humbled that to be a part of this, and I'm grateful that there are, you know, people out there like you gentlemen fighting for us and doing a great job at it and continue to do so. Just great work on your part, and I thank you on behalf of me and, you know, other service members and everybody who's worn a uniform and family members.
Really great. Well, thank you, Anthony, and have a great night. Remember, ladies and gentlemen, listeners, you can reach Vets for Warriors at 1-855-838-8255. This seems like another wonderful program. David, there are really great programs outside of the VA helping our men and women veterans and their families. You know, a few weeks ago, we had Rebecca Winkler on our show, who operates the Winkler Wish Foundation. This program is located in Crestview, Florida, and now we have the Vets for Warriors located in Piscataway, New Jersey. We would like to hear about other programs from around the country, so please call our show or send me an email at rickhurley5@msn.com. That's rickhurley5@msn.com. David, before we wind up the show, why don't you tell us a little bit about the VA's program, Coaching Into Care?
Will do, and thank you, Richard. And thank you to Anthony for being on our show tonight and for the wonderful work that he and Vets for Warriors are doing. We'd like to mention quickly two other programs, the VA's Coaching Into Care program, which is to help veterans and their families make the transition and for families to get their veterans the help they need. Coaching Into Care's toll-free is 1-888-823-7458. Again, 1-888-823-7458. And they're Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Eastern Time. And the Veteran Crisis Line 24/7 is 1-800-273-8255, and then press 1. I know we're running out of time for tonight. It's been an excellent, very informative, insightful show. I would like to thank our guest again and thank our sponsors, thank our producer of BBS Radio, Mr. Doug Newsom. We'll be back next Monday, same time, same station, and that's our show for tonight. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley. We hope you found this week's program very informative. Be sure to invite your friends and all the veterans you know to tune in next week when we'll have another great show on veterans issues. Meanwhile, you can listen to our other recorded episodes on the Veterans News Hour webpage on bbsradio.com. Thanks again for listening to the Veterans News Hour.